It was a quiet knock on my door that morning. So quiet, in fact, that I wondered if I was dreaming. Maybe if I went back to sleep, it would go away. Nope, there it was again, soft but persistent. And this time I knew it really was a knock, and it really was on the front door of my one-room cabin. What I didn't know was that I'd be hearing that knock for the rest of my life. I got up, tired, rumpled, and pulled open the door. A young woman I'd never seen before stood there, barefoot, and wearing the simple white linen dress of the campesina, as a woman who works the land is called in rural Paraguay. She was probably no more than 16, but in her eyes was the look of a mother, and something else, distress. In her arms, she held an infant. Se mambu ohasu. My baby is sick, she said, in her native Guarani. I barely understood her, but I knew it wasn't good. I looked at her baby, face gray, eyes open, too sick to cry. What was I supposed to do? Back then, I wasn't a doctor. Heck, I hadn't taken any pre-med courses. I was just a liberal arts major who dropped out of Berkeley in order to get an education, as I explained to my incredulous father. Now I was the strange gringo, a Peace Corps volunteer, living alongside a dirt road in the middle of the Paraguayan subtropics among 100 or so peasant families, trying to help them literally hack a living from the jungle. It was 30 miles to the nearest highway, 300 to the nearest hospital, and this young mother had walked most of the night from her home deeper in the jungle to get to me. I was her last resort. She was out of options. There were no medicines, no doctors, and all the home remedies and all the grandparents' ministrations obviously hadn't worked. Why not try the strange gringo? Jaha, let's go, I said, and motioned to my Honda 90, Peace Corps issue, just outside my front door. I didn't know what else to do, but I couldn't do nothing. So I helped her onto the back of my motorcycle, where she clung, sobbing, one arm clutching my waist and the other clutching her baby. And we headed for the crossroads, where my little jungle road intersected the highway. The highway was just another dirt road, but it at least saw an occasional vehicle, and one of these might transport her to the capital city 300 miles away. A half hour later, almost within sight of the highway, the sobs in my ears suddenly changed to a wail. I knew what it meant. I stopped and got off. Then I held the young mother in my arms. Speechlessly, in language that was neither English nor Guarani, I told her I was sorry. We got back on my motorcycle, turned around, and headed back. And for the next half hour, I listened to the flood of a mother's grief. Ceaseless, inconsolable, uncomprehending. The grief was hers and that of millions of mothers before her, across countries and cultures and time. That sound and her knock on my door that morning has followed me through all the intervening years. It spoke to me when, after returning home, I changed my major from liberal arts to pre-med. It guided my choice to train in family medicine when I could have opted for other residencies. It is a gentle reminder when the frustration providing care in a seemingly deaf and broken healthcare system pile up. I sometimes wonder if I shouldn't have chosen something easier, but she always clears up my doubts. I know now that she was my first patient and will remain with me until the day I see my last. Even now, if I close my eyes, I can still hear her.
I'm Suzanne Lang, and that was Dr. Rick Flinders reading from his recently released book, The Santa Rosa Reader, a personal anthology from the family practice residency. Later in the hour, Dr. Flinders will be in conversation with another doctor, Dr. Larry Slater, who many of you may know as Sonoma County's Jazz MD. Stay tuned. You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. For the past 16 years, Paula Gianturco has been documenting women's lives around the world. And Powerhouse Books has published her fifth book, Grandmother Power, A Global Phenomenon, which features stories of women involved in the global activist grandmother movement who are fighting courageously and effectively against poverty, human rights abuses, and environmental degradation to simply create a better world for their grandchildren. Stay with us. It's a novel idea. Paula Gianturco, welcome to Sonoma County.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Today we're going to talk about and explore your book, Grandmother Power, A Global Phenomenon. It's filled with colorful pictures that I believe you've taken.
I did take them.
And wonderful stories of tens of women in oral histories and your own narrative that fills us in as readers on history and culture from all over the planet. And I want to start by quoting here from your book, and it's on the 13 indigenous grandmothers. When your stone rolls along a certain length of time, you gather things with it. If you've been awake while traveling, even better. If you put that into spiritual focus, how potent it becomes. And when I read that line, I thought it really epitomized everything that you're pulling together in this book about women, grandmothers. Certainly you do talk about men in the book, but grandmothers around the planet, women around the planet who have lived life and are continuing to live life and remind us and remind people and remind children what we need to do to be good and right and safe and healthy and take care of each other.
It's a wonderful quote. I'm so glad you picked that one. It's actually something that was said by a woman who lives not too far from here. Her name is Jyoti. And she lives in the Russian River area. She convened the International Council of 13 Indigenous Grandmothers. And she's sent invitations through her spiritual network to shamans and healers all over the world and invited some 16 who could make particular contributions, she believed, to this council. There is a shared prophecy among indigenous people around the world, people as far-flung as Gabon and Brazil and Alaska. And that prophecy suggested that there would be a time when the grandmothers convened to awaken the world. And when they gathered in New York, not New York City, out at the Dalai Lama's retreat center, they discovered that there were 13. One of those grandmothers, whose name is Rita Blumenstein, had been given by her mother when she was a child 13 feathers and 13 stones with the instructions to distribute them among the 13 grandmothers whom she knew her daughter would meet sometime later in her life. So it was clear that this was a council that was founded to fulfill that prophecy. And those women, full of indigenous wisdom, which they agreed to share because the world was in such terrible condition, that they believed that the wisdom of their ancestors could help steer through a future that was opaque, that was very difficult to navigate. So every 6 months, they have a gathering on one of their indigenous lands. Last year, they were in Nepal. So each year, it's in a different place. I photographed them when they were in meeting in Sedona.
And I thought this was a good way to start because it is all about women coming together in groups to build upon their experience and strengthen one another and then radiate out into the community in a forcefulness that maybe they don't have individually.
Oh, I'm sure. Radiate out into the community is a wonderful way to express it. In fact, these groups of grandmothers, which are convened because they look around at our troubled world and say, whew, not good enough for my beloved grandchildren. So they gather in groups and get to work, tackling the issues that are most important in their communities. And that brings them to very different issues. But they call on their strength and their ability to help each other move forward. And they are, in fact, very strong. Do not underestimate these grandmothers. They bring not only their wisdom, but their energy. You know, grandmothers today are younger than grandmothers have ever been. So they bring energy. Many of them in the Northern Hemisphere have had careers, so it makes them effective. All over the world, grandmothers are living longer and starting to be grandmothers younger. You know, we have such a good healthcare system now, at least in the global north, that grandmothers can be energetic, relatively young, pretty well educated, effective, and because the boomers are now becoming grandmothers, they came of age in the 60s. They know they can change the world because they did.
And in your book, which is structured in such a way that it's not exactly geographical, the chapters are more thematic. And I was struck by the range of issues going from AIDS, HIV in Africa to politics in America to the Lolas in the Philippines, women who had been forced to be comfort women by the Japanese during World War II. Do you want to talk a little bit about them, maybe? That was a surprising bit of history that you articulate so clearly.
The Japanese government, through its military, abducted women all over Asia, wherever they had troops. And they kidnapped, essentially, and held prisoner a young adolescent girl for each of 100 soldiers in our army. Those young girls were forced to service perhaps 10 men a night. And that could go on for months and months and months. The Philippines had some 30 garrisons that doubled as brothels during the war. So there were a number of Philippine women who were so ashamed of having been forced to be sex slaves, essentially, that they didn't tell their own husbands or their own children for years and years and years. And similarly, there was radio silence in Korea, where there was an even larger number of women. There were also comfort women in Japan. No one talked about this. It was considered enormously shameful. Much to everyone's surprise, in the Philippines, in the early 90s, a woman named Rosa Henson went on television in Manila and told her story, and invited the other Lolas, the other comfort women, to come and fight with her for their rights. And slowly but surely, they gathered the courage to do that, some of them telling their stories for the first time on the radio and on television at the same time their children were learning of these terrible experiences. They banded together into groups with chapters throughout the Philippines. I interviewed the women who were part of the chapter in Manila, who are now in their 80s and 90s. They have not stopped fighting. In the late 90s, they brought a class action suit against the government of Japan, and they asked for reparations and a formal apology and a place in the history books so that subsequent generations would know about this and it wouldn't happen again. after some 10 years of making its way through the courts, that case was rejected by the Japanese Supreme Court, even though the women in the Philippines, working in concert with Comfort Women in the other parts of Asia who also brought similar suits, even though they lost, they have continued to fight. And as I interviewed them, they said to me, you know, my mother lived to be 96. I will use the rest of my years to fight on. They are so determined to quell this kind of sexual violence against women and girls everywhere that they are now building international support to stand against these issues. And they march in the streets, never mind that many of them are using walkers. They collect signatures on petitions. They speak at universities. They are formidable.
It's difficult sometimes to, in reading people's stories and what they're responding to acknowledge that there is so much abuse, so much violation, so much violence against people, against women, against children, that is that none of us are immune to. Yet there are these women who are fighting, not afraid of the military. They might be afraid or apprehensive, but embody a power that I see as uniquely female, standing against often tyranny and subjugation.
Certainly that was the case in the Philippines, and that kind of power is the reason for the title of the book, Grandmother Power, indeed. Sometimes it takes many years to acknowledge that kind of power, but a great motivator is to know that the world is just plain not good enough for your grandchildren, and you don't have lots and lots and lots of time to make it better. So these grandmothers are highly motivated. They are working on important issues. Similarly, the grandmothers in Guatemala, for example, are operating the Plan International Hotline for child abuse. And they have discovered that it's the grandmothers whom people want to talk with about these issues. I mean, for one thing, they have the time to listen to the telephone conversations, which can be long and complicated and difficult. They have the compassion to be empathetic. But they also have the wisdom to understand as they hear what kind of referrals need to be made. Sometimes people should be sent to the police. Sometimes they should be sent to therapists. Sometimes they should go immediately to the hospital.
And let's say that this issue in Guatemala in particular is all about child abuse.
Child abuse, exactly.
That was an issue that I wasn't familiar with, that it seems to be has penetrated their culture.
The stereotype of men in Guatemala, obviously not true of everyone, but there is it's a very machismo culture. I went with them. They have been going into the villages and teaching what it means to be a good parent, because they want to prevent this kind of abuse as well as deal with it. So I went with them into the villages. They take with them games, sort of lotto and bingo type games, and engage whole communities, whole villages, men and women, in playing games about what makes good parenting, laughs and hugs and talking and listening, among other things. Those women are sometimes, I interviewed one woman who was 80. She had been threatened by a man with a machete. I mean, they are not welcomed into these houses where they know abuse is underway. But she said, I had been trained. I said, you don't have to act like that. Here is a brochure that will give you resources to deal with your anger. And she just stood him down. I mean, it is really a great strength that these women bring to those issues. Many of them had, they told me, been beaten themselves And that redoubled their determination to bring a halt to this.
Tell me about your process. You've talked to women from literally all over the world, different cultures, different backgrounds, and your book is accessible. The information, I felt like I was there with these women, and your setting up of the cultural and historical context was an easy read as well. There was just a nice flow.
Thank you.
Your process of choosing these women, choosing these places, and then once you met them, how did you engage in these cultural settings?
Well, let me talk a little bit about the conversations that you were describing. I really felt very privileged to be having those conversations. And my great dream about this book as I was doing it was that I would be able to give you the experience that you described, that you would feel as if you too were sitting on the floor of somebody's hut and having an informal conversation in which she was telling you her story, just as I was privileged to have that experience. So thank you for that. It's a really nice compliment. I also had a sense from the beginning that the book wasn't just my book. I think about this as our book because I interviewed 120 women in 17 grandmother groups in 15 countries. So I ranged over a very large part of this planet's geography in doing this work. It was very important to me that the women's voices were their own. So I simply edited what sometimes were several hours worth of interviews, just as you do for your radio program, and hoped that I brought forth not just the story but also the personalities of these women who otherwise don't have an opportunity to be heard. After I finished drafting each chapter, I sent it back to the interpreters in every country to be read back to the women whom I'd interviewed, because it mattered more than anything else that they felt I had represented them accurately. But I've always felt that this was not my book. It's just happenstance that my name is on the cover, because it really was an ongoing act of engagement, and I still hear from these women. The website, which is globalgrandmotherpower.com, includes updates from these groups because they keep in touch with me and tell me what's going on. So anybody who becomes interested through reading the book can stay up to date by going to the website.
I was struck by some of the stories coming out of the women in Israel. And I'd like you to talk about that a little bit, what that experience was like for you to be with them.
Well, I'll tell you quickly the story about the grandmothers in Israel who are doing something that surprises many people. Every day, 70 to 100,000 Palestinians go through the military checkpoints to get to jobs and works and doctored work and doctor's appointments to schools and so forth. And it is a strategy of the Israel Defense Forces to hold them at the checkpoints. I suppose I don't know of a military organization in the world that is not taught to maintain power and control. And the idea of the delay at the checkpoints is a way to maintain control. But the delays were extensive. I mean, 6 hours and 8 hours. Women gave birth at the checkpoints. Babies died at the checkpoints. Palestinians were not allowed to have medical access. People died at the checkpoints. And the Jewish Israeli grandmothers felt that that way of dealing with the Palestinians was completely unacceptable. So 400 of them, organized into a group called Maxim Watch. Maxim Watch means checkpoint watch. And these grandmothers, two by two, have gone to monitor their own soldiers at the checkpoints throughout the West Bank every single day since 2002, the second Intifada. And they issue reports to the journalists, they issue reports on the internet, and they issue reports to the Knesset when there is abuse, which unfortunately is an ongoing problem. But they have managed to gain some surprising, I must say, reluctant support, even from the IDF, whose spokesman recently said, "We've learned that there are things that can be done better." So some, not all checkpoints now, have shade. Some of them have bathrooms. Some of them have humanitarian assistance hotlines. Some of them, again, not all, have places where Muslims can spread their prayer rugs if they are in the checkpoints when it's time to pray. So there are some improvements. The grandmothers are not satisfied. They say, "We are not the social workers of the checkpoints," one woman said to me. But they at least have been able to make some progress. And this is an unbelievably controversial kind of behavior for them to be doing. Soldiers in their own families don't support it. It has caused real rifts between them and the people whom they love most. And yet they have just won the highest award that is given by the Association for Civil Rights in Israel.
And that's very much where they were moving from, is a civil rights issue, not a political one.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's exactly right. I went with them all over the West Bank. I will say that they are unbelievably courageous. I thought, you know, I am not a war photographer.
I was kind of nervous for you, somehow reading through this, that I wondered if you were nervous.
I was, but I was also safe because I was with them. I mean, they really do know what they're doing, and they've done it for a long time. But I am not used to being in that kind of an environment, and this is an occupying force, and there's a lot of tension, and there are circumstances that I hadn't witnessed up close. So I wasn't comfortable, that's for sure.
I'm talking with Paola Gianturco about her book, Grandmother Power, A Global Phenomenon, which is not only a book with lots of stories of courage and innovation, but it's got some fabulous pictures in it, too, of colorful, smiling women laughing, hugging. And I wonder if you could talk about your own process as a photographer. Here you're interviewing people, often with a translator, and taking pictures as well. So how is that for you?
I always do the interviews first. Because I find if you've talked to someone for an hour, you begin to have a sense of who they are and how you might represent them in a photograph. And to do that any earlier feels really invasive to me. So I wait until we have established some rapport. I work very hard to avoid a sense of the Spanish Inquisition. I sometimes show pictures of my own grandchildren, and they show me pictures of theirs. And I always end the interviews by inviting them to ask me questions, because reciprocity seems to me to be fair. But I don't take pictures too soon. All of them have agreed to be part of this project by the time I am talking with them. I always start by showing them my other books, which look quite like this. That gives them a sense of what they're really getting into. Even if they're not literate, they can see what it means to be part of a book like this. And they're very interested in women in other places. So often that's a very engaging beginning point of departure. I feel much more comfortable doing this than I did when I started the first book. This is book number 5. I remember going to Poland and Turkey, which was sort of a test run for me, thinking, why would anyone talk to me? first of all, everybody in the world, particularly in what had been Eastern Bloc countries and in the developing world, assumes that people in the United States are all rich. Second of all, I am well educated, and many of them haven't been even to the second grade, if at all. So it was hard for me to imagine why they would talk to me openly. And what I discovered immediately was that I was talking with women whom people don't listen to and who aren't heard. The fact that I had come so far to do nothing but listen to them opened up windows that I would never have imagined. They told me things I would never have asked, and they were very open and very comfortable. I was honored by that.
Well, I'm honored to have you in the studio today, and I want to thank you and encourage our readers to pick up a copy of this lovely book and share it with a mother, a grandmother, or a grandother. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to KRCV's A Novel Idea.
Look now.
Sonoma County, California has a rich tradition of family medicine, and Santa Rosa's residency program has been churning out family docs for years. Larry Slater, whom some of you may know as Sonoma County's Jazz MD from his regular hosting of KRCB's Jazz Connections, well, Larry's also a family doctor and talks with Dr. Rick Flinders about his just-published Santa Rosa Reader. Rick is a natural storyteller and with reflection and directness brings his passion for working with students and patients alike into his writing. Here's Larry Slater in conversation with Dr. Rick Flinders.
Well, let me set the stage for a minute before we begin. Dr. Flinders and I are both family physicians. We both trained at Community Hospital, now called Sutter Hospital, in the late 1970s. I went on to a career in family medicine, but always stayed connected to the training program as both a teacher and as the director of the medical student clerkship for almost 30 years. Rick Flinders stayed in academia as director of the hospital's medicine residency teaching service. What motivated you to write the book? This is a book that called the Santa Rosa Reader that basically is an anthology of your thoughts about the training program and really about our chosen profession.
Sure. What motivated me to write the book? This is a special place. The stories are really not about me. They're about the place that trained me and the experience that place opened the door to in a lifetime of practice of family medicine. And you know what I'm talking about, Larry, because you've gone through the same door. In fact, if you have a family physician in Sonoma County, they were probably trained in our program. At last count, I think we're 55% of all the family docs in Sonoma County, whether in Sutter or Kaiser or in community health clinics, were trained in our program. And thanks in large part to you, Larry. I mean, you've been training medical students here for as long as I've been practicing. And in fact, if you look in my book, and I don't want to embarrass Larry here, but in the acknowledgments I say, Larry Slater was my senior resident when I was an intern, and as faculty, taught generations of medical students who passed through here. And when I think of the kind of family physicians we as faculty aspire to train, Larry always comes to mind. Okay, why did I write the book? Not to praise Larry, but he's been a great companion and teacher for me over these years. I wrote the book to talk about a place that is special. And I think people who live in Sonoma County and elsewhere need to know that we're all lucky that this institution, this hospital, this training program has been here.
So who is the audience, Rick? Who is your intended audience for the book?
Well, in a short word, everybody. But I also want to reach those students who might be aspiring to a career in medicine, family practice or otherwise, because my experience, and I think yours too, has been that we made a great choice. We were lucky to have been in family medicine, particularly at the time that we have. And the other story in the book maybe is the history of our specialty. Family practice didn't come out of a vacuum, and it didn't happen as an accident. I think it grew out of the social reform movement of the 1960s. And you know I'm a child of the 60s.
As am I. And I think most folks out there, Rick, I think it's fair to say, don't really understand that the discipline of family medicine is relatively new, that our specialty was formed in 1969 and that it grew out of general practice, if you will, and that our hospital, the old community hospital, now Sutter Hospital, actually has been training generalists, GPs, since what, about 1938?
Since 1938.
So not only have we populated Sonoma County with family physicians now, but have been doing it for decades.
And it also leads, historically, it has produced a stream of family physicians who have lived in Sonoma County while they trained in Sonoma County, and because Sonoma County is a nice place to be, stayed in Sonoma County. And so what Sonoma County has had that's unique, maybe to most other places in the country, is a rich tradition of empowered family practice, such that we've been on the staffs, we've been on the faculty, we've been on the teaching cadre for all of these years. Not every community has that resource, so that when we became born as a specialty in family medicine, the fertile soil, so to speak, of general practice and the strength that it's had here was a natural place for family practice to begin.
Yeah, and I suspect most people also don't understand that in so many communities, and particularly the East Coast of the United States, that the medical world is entirely specialty dominated and that family physicians have had trouble even finding a role in major metropolitan areas, Boston, New York, and probably Los Angeles as well.
It seems like we've always had to fight for respect, and we have been assiduous in trying to establish an academic tradition of research in what we do and how it benefits patients. But I think the ultimate vote is with the people who come to see us, who choose us. And it's harder and harder to find enough family practice or primary care physicians today to take care of the great part of our population.
Absolutely. Rick, in working on your book, what did you discover about the genesis of family practice, which we now call family medicine? How did it come to be?
It's interesting you mention that, because I was aware generally, as probably you were, that we came out of this tradition of general practice by physicians that we knew who set it up here. John Durvin, Ed Neal, Nick Grace, Clyde Wellick, Frank Norman. Those are icons in the tradition of general practice. I knew that we came from that background. What I didn't know was many of us were pretty suspicious of the medical profession in those days. Remember the don't trust anyone over 30 and question authority. Well, the AMA and the medical profession in general, remember through the 50s and 60s, or through the 50s at least, and maybe it was a misperception on our parts because we suspected everybody, but to me, in 1964, the AMA was a little different from the FBI or the CIA. Now, that's distorted. I confess to that now. But we suspected authority, and it represented a depersonalization, the overspecialization of a practice that is ultimately personal. And that's why we became family physicians. In those days, I learned that Santa Rosa was known as the Athens of family medicine. Now, I didn't make up that term. Joseph Sugar actually is the guy who I first heard it from. But, you know, without being self-adulatory or anything, we did have a rich tradition here. And it was embodied in the living presence and practice of physicians like those I mentioned.
You have a chapter in your book, Rick, called The Four Pillars.
Yeah.
Well, what are the four pillars?
Well, my career experience, and yours too, has not only been practicing, but teaching as well. And Santa Rosa has generated a national reputation among students who graduate from medical schools who are interested in family practice. In fact, Larry, 90% of all applicants to family practice residencies from U.S. medical schools apply to our program. So we have this reputation, and I think most of the time we've earned it. So what makes us special? Why us and not, you know, Salinas or Ventura or Boise, Idaho or Houston, Texas? They have good programs too. What makes us attractive, I believe, is a commitment to a philosophy of education that we didn't invent, but we gave language to back in 2006 when we were really questioned as to are we valuable enough to pay the cost to keep us going. And what we did was give language to the principles that we had learned under people like Jim Good and Lou Menikoff and John Durbin and all the rest. What constitutes the philosophy of education at Santa Rosa? We call them pillars. Number one, supervised autonomy. Now, what the hell does that mean? It means a model of teaching and learning in which residents, young physicians, experience the heat of primary responsibility with supervision for the care of patients. In other words, when you enter our program, you experience what it means to have to make decisions, often critical decisions, in the care and the life of your patients. It's important. It's also important to be supervised by experienced faculty like yourself and the rest of us. Number two, the second pillar is what we call an environment of academia. Now, this is not the ivory tower concept of academia where people do research far removed from the everyday life of medical practice. We define an environment of academia as an environment in which students teach and teachers learn. Lifelong learning, I believe, is a developmental challenge for physicians. It's probably for any profession. How do you keep learning? So we learn alongside each other. The third pillar is called a tradition of humanism and social justice. And this probably relates most to what I learned when I began to study the history of family medicine. How did we happen? We define this a tradition in which we acknowledge that access to care is the equal right of all patients, and that professional medical training is also an intense period of personal growth and development. Residency is an intense 3-year experience. You know that. You remember. And you grow, not just as a physician, but from what you witness of human suffering and human joy and triumph and sorrow and all of that, you have to accommodate that, and you grow as a human being. We've been told that by our medical professors for centuries, William Osler, William Carlos Williams. If you keep your eyes and your ears open, the very tools that we use as physicians, you will grow, not only as a doctor, but as a human being. That's our third pillar. The fourth one we call a strong family medicine identity. And that is simply that residents experience and identify with what it means to be a family physician. Medical students came here in the early years. They saw you as the preceptor of the student clerkship. They saw you in practice. It's not like you had to preach to them. They saw what family physicians do, and they saw what family physicians value, and they saw the role that we have in patients' lives. When they get here, we have as many faculty as possible precepting them daily in their clinics and supervising their care in the hospital. So I think we can say with credibility that we give people who train here an experience of what it means to be a family doctor.
Let's take a step back, and because a lot of our audience, I don't think, understands medical training and who our residents are and where they come from. So after you get your bachelor's degree, then you go to medical school for 4 years, and then you choose a specialty, and family medicine is one such specialty. and then depending on the specialty, you have what's essentially an apprenticeship. It's a 3-year program in family medicine. It's 3 years in pediatrics, 5 years in surgery, and on and on. And it's those years for which we have the residents. So when we talk about resident physicians, we're talking about their 3 years that is post-medical school and before they enter some sort of a practice. And our residents are truly a diverse part of humanity, I think you'd say. You and I have seen changes over the years, but they're still phenomenally idealistic, a very socially conscious group of people.
Absolutely. They have some experience of the world. In terms of their commitment and demonstrated experience in serving everybody, including the underserved. Now, we're not exclusively for the underserved, but that is a prime motive that attracts the people who come here and always has been.
What do you think most of our graduates do these days? Do we, as a residency program, track our graduates? Where have they ended up?
Wow. That's been dynamic and has changed. When you and I trained, half of us stayed in Sonoma County and opened private practices. It was the golden age of private practice of the family doc here in Sonoma County. And over the years, because of changes in medicine and the distribution and economics of healthcare, it's been harder and harder to run the business of a private practice. And you did it longer than most. And what's happened are those people who are in private practice have kind of been absorbed by larger integrated healthcare groups like Kaiser and Sutter Medical Group, et cetera. But I would say the overwhelming majority of our residents now join the community health centers. In fact, 7 of the community health centers that are in Sonoma County were founded by graduates of our program in the last 25 years.
So tell us what a community health center is.
A community health center is a full-service ambulatory clinic that provides all the spectrum of primary care services to those people who can't afford to get access to private physicians. And, boy, we could get into the healthcare economics and the issues of the right to access to care. But however you look at it, it's harder and harder for people to get the care they need at the cost that's extracted.
Yeah, no question. Rick, you mentioned earlier that we're children of the 60s and that our experience as self-perceived revolutionaries somehow molded us into a career in family medicine, which was brand new and a bit revolutionary in its own time. You know, do you think there's a connection between the social upheavals in the 60s and the creation of family medicine as a specialty?
Absolutely. I wouldn't have known it at the time, all right? But when you look back at the 60s, it was more than long hair and psychedelic drugs and rock and roll. Pretty good rock and roll, I might add. But it was about the questioning of values. Mario Savio, you know, who was branded as a radical at Berkeley in 64 because he was the voice piece of the free speech movement. You know, he's attributed to being a radical and an off-campus communist and all of these things. But what Mario wanted is what we all did. And what he's not quoted for saying is when he got arrested, one of the frustrated police officers asked him, "Mario, what do you want?" And he said, "All we want is a population that's healthy, well-educated, gainfully employed, and a society in which race and gender no longer divide us." Now, what's radical? Or that's Thomas Jefferson. That's George Washington. That's Abraham Lincoln. Those are the values that drove our founding as a nation. And so in the 60s, we were a bit arrogant and claimed credit for a lot of things that were really the contributions of our ancestors. But we gave voice and language and action to things like civil rights. The Civil Rights Act was passed in 1965. It was the most far-reaching legislation for civil rights since the Bill of Rights. In 1964, Medicare or Social Security extended benefits to include complete medical care for the elderly. Women's Lib grew out of the 60s, and a variety of other socially conscious, politically conscious movements were part of that time. So we can't take credit for it all. But consciously or unconsciously, I think a lot of us gravitated towards family medicine because it represented a kind of medicine that was personal. People that didn't force your patients to go to off to some specialist without necessarily needing to do that. We wouldn't hide behind a white coat or jargon. And we were there for our patients, 24/7 a lot of the time. And that's the kind of medicine that we gravitated to because we felt the social responsibility to provide complete care to all people, whether they were insured or uninsured, whether they were eligible or not.
And I think there was also a focus of seeing the patient as an individual in a complex setting, as a member of a family, as a member of a community, and not as an organic disease process. I once heard it said that family physicians view their patients as healthy until proven otherwise, while the specialists view their patients as ill until proven otherwise.
That's the medical model. Yeah, and that's why family practice, I think, was unique.
Yeah.
And again, we didn't invent that. That came out of general practice. You know, Osler, the ultimate specialist, Sir William Osler, he said in a graduation speech back in the 20s, aspire to that noblest of all medical professions, to be a generalist, to take care of those things that aren't defined by an organ or a complaint.
Rick, you know, we've both been practicing in Sonoma County for quite a number of decades now, and we've seen some pretty dramatic changes in the medical landscape in Sonoma County. I think you'd agree. How do you view these changes from both a business perspective and how they've actually changed the practice of medicine?
Well, fundamentally, we believe that healthcare is a right. And that right has become more and more constrained over the last 30 years by economics. We are the only nation in the world that does not see as a right of its citizens the provision of universal health care. We used to have a partner, but that was South Africa, and they finally went to universal care too. But it's odd. It's odd because for all the things that we are so successful for, you know, the initiative of capitalism and the invention and the technology, we perform miracles every day. And you and I think, grew up with the impression that we were the best healthcare in the world. Well, that's not borne out. We pay twice as much per person as any country in the world. And you say, well, maybe, or so our care is twice as good. No, it's not even half as good. I mean, it's not even average. Of 13 industrialized nations in the country and then in the world, we rank 13th. Frankly, I love medicine. I love its practice. I love teaching it. But I am embarrassed by our healthcare system or lack of a healthcare system.
So I hear you're working on a new book. This book, the Santa Rosa Reader, is available, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But you're on to a new project, I understand. Tell us about that.
We are at a tipping point, so to speak, in terms of our obligation of basic rights to our citizens. And the economics are going to bring us to a halt. And what I became interested in is what are the traditions, the roots that we grew from, and how can we apply what succeeded in those times that are relevant to the current times and that can brighten the future. And that's not going back to the horse and buggy days. It's not even that we have to do everything that we once did. I mean, you and I enjoyed the time of practice when we could deliver babies and hospitalize our patients and even work in the emergency room. I don't think that's going to be the scope of practice of family doctors in the future. But what will remain are those two things I said, the durable relationship over time, the personal knowledge of our patients over time, the efficient and cost-conscious ways that we can practice responsibly. And the other is we can extend our practice to those areas of care that are ambulatory, that are palliative care, that are advanced illness management, and include hospice. Those are the areas in which we can expand, I believe. So the future family doctor, I think, will be, some of us will be in the hospital delivering babies and taking care of patients, but the majority of us will be basically in our offices and extended, I think, into systems that allow us to the home. Many people could be cared for at home, even for things that we hospitalize people for now, and particularly at end of life. You know, 50% of hospital expenses through Medicare are in the last 30 days of life. We can keep people alive with multiple organ system failure for 6 weeks, a month, or two. To what benefit? Except that it deprives us of the resources we need to take care of people when they're being born, when women are pregnant who need health care services. It's a poor distribution of our resources for what we get for it. So the family doctor of the future, I think, will not only be the change that we need, but lead the change.
Well, Rick, I sure appreciate you talking with us. And I think probably the people of Sonoma County have a better sense of who our residency program is, who our residents are, but particularly who family physicians are, because that's really what we're all about. Where could people buy your book if they wanted to do this? You are getting rich off this, correct?
Oh, of course. not a penny of the proceeds of this book come to me. It was written as a labor of love for the profession that we love, for the practice that we love. And it was a way of, in a weak effort to try to pay something back to the program that sustained us. The proceeds are all going to the residency program. And you can buy the book anywhere, any outlet, Amazon.com, Kindle, the local bookstores. My recommendation is it's also available through the people who helped me publish it, the Sonoma County Medical Association. Steve Osborne helped me edit it. Lynn McLaughlin helped the graphics and all, such that the book's about $10. If you buy it through the medical association, the residents, you get $7. If you buy it through Amazon or Kindle or all those other outlets, they take 70% and give the residency program 30%.
So how does one buy it through the medical association?
SCMA.org. Boom. It'll flash right up there.
Yeah. Thanks, Rick. I sure appreciate you coming in. It was really enjoyable.
Larry, thank you. And thank you for the years of inspiration and teaching and collegiality that you've provided too.
Well, thanks, Rick. And thanks for the kudos.
Thank you, Larry Slater, in conversation with Rick Flinders. You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. You can subscribe to our podcasts at krcb.org and listen through iTunes. Production assistance is from Sean Knight. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening.
The beautiful broken place, that well of endless sorrow, forever and a day. Sing like there's no tomorrow, the beautiful broken place that gave you a curtained freedom, your bane and your saving grace. You showed them you did not need them, the beautiful broken place. Sweet curse of disenchantment, Spanish without a trace, the accent on hope abandoned, that beautiful broken place. The strength of your greatest weakness that usually goes to waste, plug in the blue-eyed beacon, that beautiful broken place. You could not outshine your twilight, your demons were not outpaced, they still scratch away at the good.